And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of November 27th, 2020. Today, we're happy to have as a guest the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network, Sarah Dooling. How are you doing, Sarah?
I'm doing so well. I'm so happy to be here, Ted. How are you doing?
Very well, very, very well. So, over the last several years and accelerating over the course of 2020, the climate movement has shifted in its, I guess, perspective on the world and has come to see the issue of climate change as having many implications that are deeply sewn into many other topics, deeply integrated in ways that, you know, 10 years ago, we talked about how climate change touches everything. But all of a sudden, with the pandemic and whatnot, we've come to realize that everything really is close together. One of the topics where I think we can see that kind of thing manifest is in the question of housing, especially when we bring in things like the pandemic, the impact of pollution on people's ability to resist COVID, the need for clean housing. All of a sudden you see, well, all this stuff is linked up and could be addressed in some coherent way. I mean, I'm getting way too many big words. Sarah, tell me, the question of affordable, clean housing, tell me the story about that and why it's a climate issue.
That's a great question. And I agree with you, Ted. The pandemic has revealed the ways in which our lives, not only in our own lives is housing an integral part of our health and well-being, but that in the lives of our neighbors and in our communities and the people who live the next town over. So housing is so important. It offers us stability. If it's safe and healthy, our bodies tend to be safe and healthy as well. And it's just foundational as a place where we have refuge. Now we work in our homes, many of us, not all of us, but many of us do. And so housing is really essential to our society and to our well-being. You know, the affordable housing piece, as many of your listeners, our listeners probably know, has become more urgent, especially since the pandemic has hit people pretty hard. And it's really clear that with people getting furloughed, with people getting laid off, with companies shutting, that we need to make sure people stay housed. We need to make sure people earn enough money to pay only 30% mm-hmm. of their monthly income should go to housing. That's a rule of thumb. Anything beyond 30% of somebody's paycheck on a monthly basis for housing is too expensive. And I've been in situations in my life on a temporary basis where I have paid, you know, close to 45% of my monthly income on housing. It was really, really hard. And so understanding the importance of affordable housing means really understanding that people are making enough money, receiving enough assistance if they need it to keep themselves and their families and their, you know, and whoever else lives with them housed. And so
there's a short term of, easy to say short term, but I mean, right now there is the eviction crisis, which sort of folds into this much longer term fundamental that people need housing to have a coherent life, right? Decent. Yeah.
Right. And increasingly, people, it's unfortunate that Governor Baker did not extend the statewide eviction moratorium. It's very unfortunate. There are other processes in place now that may offer some assistance. However, you know, keeping people housed now is a way of keeping our neighborhoods, our communities healthy. We don't want people to be evicted, end up sleeping in cars or with their neighbors or friends and unintentionally contributing to a rising COVID infection rate. So what has been made, I think, abundantly clear is that housing and health are intimately connected. And as you were saying before, the climate emergency during this time of the pandemic has shifted and is moving in towards this space where climate, housing, and health overlap. So it's really clear that the climate emergency right now is deeply bound to the goals of climate justice. And the pandemic has revealed how the devastating consequences of these, of the lack of affordable housing, the threat of COVID and other respiratory illnesses for folks that live near highways and polluting facilities are really being felt disproportionately hard by Black and Brown low-income communities. And those are the folks that are getting really sick right now.
Would you say that the question of the affordable clean housing is a climate imperative, because we cannot solve the climate question without having, I mean, carbon dioxide, if it comes from a poor person's house or a rich man's house, is still carbon dioxide, right? So addressing the energy usage in disadvantaged communities is like a good climate thing to do, but it's also a morally correct thing to do. But those are all tied up, right? Is that a fair way to put it?
Yes, it's all tied up. And the way I think about this, Ted, is that we are only as strong as the weakest among us, right? We are only as resilient as the most vulnerable of us. And I think of folks living in leaky housing with gas stoves, gas heaters near a highway or a landfill or a paint thinning industry, some kind of polluting industry. Those are the folks typically now that are getting sick from COVID. And those are also happen to be the people that have a higher likelihood of paying more for their insufficient, inadequate housing, and in some cases have a higher likelihood of being evicted because they've lost their job, or they are low-income wage earners and their job has been disrupted right now. And so they're not bringing home as much income to pay for their housing. And now these are the households that are now making a choice. Do I pay rent or my mortgage, or do I pay my car note, or do I buy food? And so the climate emergency is really now this nexus of a housing crisis, an affordable housing crisis, the pandemic, and, you know, emissions that continue unabated. So the climate movement is really in thinking about a resilient future and thinking about a future where we have clean energy accessible by everybody, affordable for everybody, and equitably distributed, that gets us to zero emissions by 2040. That's the climate movement. And centering, starting with communities that are suffering the most in these three overlapping crises, is the, from my perspective, the place that will show the most change the quickest. These are the folks that will directly benefit and receive the most benefits. Mm-hmm.
Benefits, and I guess from my, I keep coming back to the idea that it's not the communities that benefit get the most benefit. It's not some zero sum game, right?
No,
the people that benefit the most at the same time benefit the rest of us, because there's, you know, we're resolving this intractable part of the climate crisis, that of you know, building efficiency and, you know, and again, I keep saying it's all tied up, but yeah, it's not a one-way street where some people benefit and some people don't. It's the fact that this is the only path forward is to solve the problem for everyone. I saw some tweet earlier today saying, you know, Dwight Eisenhower saying that, you know, if you couldn't solve a problem, he would keep expanding the scope until he could solve the problem, right? So instead of saying, well, we have to cut down carbon pollution, we say, okay, this is a much bigger statement, and the way to resolve it is through affordable, clean housing for people that need it, right?
Yes, right. And this is a really important point, Ted, that you're making and that I'm holding up now, is that we are all connected to each other. You know, Brockton and Newton, we're all part of the Commonwealth, and we have a collective goal to reduce our emissions. If we fail to involve low-income brown and black communities, they will be excluded from our livable, breathable future.
And I maintain that there was a quote I saw somewhere saying that you can't have a fossil fuel-based economy unless you have sacrifice zones where you can put these polluting, right? And you can't have the sacrifice zones unless you have some kind of systemic racism that discounts some people, right? And so, again, it's all this stuff's all tied up even building these plants, which nobody wants, is tied in as well.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, your comments remind me that you're sort of doing a systems map about, for example, how the extractive, violent economy of fossil fuel industries, you know, that translates directly into really bad air quality for communities that are living in apartments and housing along a highway, which impacts their health and their children's health. And so respiratory illness is a huge problem. And I think part of MCAN, part of what I'm doing at MCAN is trying to dismantle this logic of disposability, is basically what you've described.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with our 60 chapter nodes around the state, try to build up resilient plans and programs that start where we are hurting the most,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. And moving away from the logic of disposability into a logic of communal dependency, right? We're all dependent on each other. And, you know, a sacrifice zone in Springfield, potentially with the Palmer biomass burning, impacts the entire Commonwealth. And so thinking about our inner connectivity is it follows from understanding that we are dealing in this intersectional space and this nexus of a housing crisis, a health crisis, and the climate crisis.
So tell me, how is MCAN, are there specifics that sort of people hang their hat on as to what, you know, here's an example of how MCAN is connecting these things together?
That's great. Yes. And I'm really excited about this. MCAN has been partnering with the Fairmount Indigo CDC Collaborative, Community Development Corporation Collaborative, the past 4 or 5 months. And we have convened people to talk about how the housing and health and climate nexus can be developed into, at this point, a campaign focused on a regulatory body in the state. And I'll talk about that in a minute. In our partnership with the Boston Society for Architecture, we are currently offering a 4-part webinar series on affordable housing is a climate solution. And the goal of that 4-part series is to really bring together the design professionals with MCAN's energy efficiency, renewable energy, community choice aggregation, net zero stretch code advocates, and build this nexus in terms of a coalition of folks that really want to make sure that the retrofitting of affordable housing is done equitably. It's done to the best available science and technology, and it is done thoughtfully, because oftentimes I've been in conversations with experts around passive house standards, sort of the most stringent standard for a low energy, clean energy, energy efficient building there is.
But passive house being a description of a methodology, right? That's it's a funny word, but it describes how you build a house very particularly. Yes.
Yes, with an incredibly tight, what's called the building envelope is incredibly tight. There's no transfer of air in and out of the building skin. And so some of our discussions have focused on, are the passive house standards economically feasible for places like, or for houses like triple deckers in Jamaica Plain that are very leaky? A retrofit standard that is very stringent can be very, very expensive. There are some nuanced approaches that we don't have a clear answer yet, but that are part of our conversation about how do we move forward to make sure that people have clean indoor air, that their utility bills are kept low, and that they can remain as a tenant or a low-income homeowner without the threat of an upgrade starting a displacement process.
I mean, I having grown up in a town with a lot of triple deckers, it is a fascinating exercise to think of all of the connections between the renter, the owner, the technology, the city. I mean, there's so many things that would go into having a coherent plan to upgrade a lot of sort of, just as an example, triple decker homes. I mean, that's a fascinating problem, right? And a big, so you do need a lot of different, as we say, disciplines, a lot of different perspectives in the room into some sort of so that everyone's voice gets heard, because there's a lot of ways to go wrong if you have that many issues and that many, opportunity. So that's really interesting. Really interesting.
Yes. And one of our campaigns, because as folks on on our call know, we are about grassroots and mobilizing people to express strategies for getting to net zero, or actually getting to zero emissions by 2040. One of our advocacy campaigns right now is targeting the regulatory body known as the Energy Efficiency Advisory Council. And this is a regulatory body that sets...
It's Mass State.
Yes, it's a state regulatory body that sets the Department of Public Utilities budget in 3-year cycles. And right now they are conducting what are called listening sessions, hearing from advocates about proposals for the upcoming budget. And we have been working with some of our advocates, putting forward a couple of different proposals, one of which includes funding incentives, to retrofit affordable housing to passive house standards. And yes, and so allocating up to $10,000 per unit to be retrofitted. Now, some of our listeners may say $10,000, that's a drop in the bucket. That won't make a bit of difference. I'm not here to say that $10,000 is the total amount of money needed. It is a feasible request from the Department of Public Utilities. And so this is why I believe not only do we need state funds to support the retrofitting of affordable housing, you know, we need private investment as well to support that initiative and that effort.
Wow. So there's a lot going on there. So tell me, if the people listen, so MCAN's got a big project ahead of it. Right. If people wanted to help out, what kinds of stuff would they think about doing?
Oh, this is a great suggestion. So if folks on that are listening to our podcast right now, if you are interested in learning more about the EEAC, if you want to provide written or spoken testimony specifically related to passive house incentives for passive house retrofits of affordable housing, you can please reach out to me by email. And it is my first name, Sarah, at massclimateaction.net. I would love to connect with you. MCAN is working with several advocates and coalitions on this issue. If you have expertise in energy efficiency or passive house technologies, or if you're a resident that has gone through a retrofit of your unit, part of our second webinar that we are co-hosting with the Boston Society for Architecture, what I hope to have on that webinar are some resident perspectives on the experience of going through a retrofit process and working with new kinds of technologies in their living spaces, right? Oftentimes designers, they have a very specific intention for how they want a redesigned space to work and operate. And sometimes those expectations fall short because the people who live there don't fully understand what an air source heat pump is and what it does. So the importance of working with residents, showing them, you know, how this how an air source heat pump works, what to expect in terms of the utility bill and maintenance is super important.
Interesting. So we're into the holiday season, right? We have there are a succession of days that face us. There's of course Turkey Day, but there's the famous Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday, and then another day that I think is important for people to know about, right?
Yes, and that day is December 1, Giving Tuesday. And this is a day of collective generosity, and a day when people around the world, not just the United States, but people around the world show up for organizations that do good work, that align with their values, like MCAN. And so we are about the power of people to create a clean energy future that is accessible and affordable for everyone, getting us to zero emissions by 2040. That's our vision. And as a grassroots organization, we have over 60 volunteer chapters across the state, all of which are pushing for equitable, affordable climate solutions in their towns and cities. And we believe that modeling local level change demonstrates to state leaders that we also need state leadership on climate change. Right. And so our Giving Tuesday goal, so this is just one day, December 1, our goal for that day is $10,000. I think it might be helpful for people to know how their money would be helpful for MCAN. So, for example, $5,000 will allow MCAN to upgrade technology for all of our staff working remotely. You know, we need to upgrade our laptops and think about sort of distributed technology strategy.
It's a whole new set of infrastructure that needs to be developed given where we are, right?
Exactly. $1,500 will help us build out our virtual advocacy toolkit. And this is as the organization has pivoted to the virtual realm, we are really wanting to support our advocates in being effective in the virtual realm and projecting their voices to both local and state level decision makers. And developing a virtual advocacy toolkit is part of how we want to support our advocates and mobilize our power. Mm-hmm. So we need somebody to help us translate our toolkit into Spanish. And that is what $1,500, where that donation would go. $2,500 helps MCAN to continue to offer our webinars at no cost. We really don't want to have any barriers to people learning more about how these overlapping crises can be rolled into effective advocacy campaigns at the state level, legislative or regulatory, but also at the municipal level. $500. I would love somebody to donate $500, which will give MCAN a subscription to a foundation library and allow MCAN to write grants. Foundations are shifting their priorities. Nonprofits are shifting their priorities. And increasingly, foundations are supporting nonprofits working at this nexus of housing, health, and climate. Having access to a foundation library would help MCAN stay ahead of the game.
That would multiply itself several times, right?
Yes.
That's sort of interesting.
Exactly. And $10 is also important. And $10 contributes to our unrestricted funds. And for those of you listening, restricted funds are those that are tied to a grant or to a donor-specified campaign or program area. Equally important, however, are the unrestricted funds that allow MCAN to do things that are creative and not necessarily tied to some administrative deliverable, like a report. Anyway, yes, so there are many, many different ways that people's donations and support will help MCAN move into 2021 to support our advocates, to work for local change and connect us and push the Commonwealth to be a leader at the state level.
That is, so tell me, where, if someone wanted to give on Giving Tuesday, what would they do? Is there a website? What's the?
You can go to our website. There is a one-time donation button tab that you will see on our website, and that is probably the easiest way to give right now.
Right, we will put in a link to the to that that site in the blog, which will be up. Actually, what I should do is, well, I'll put up a link to that in the blog, which is also on the MCAN website at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can dance along the menu across the top of the page and get to that donate button where the Giving Tuesday opportunity is there. If you want to send an email to complain about or to say how great the podcast is or what we should be doing different, send an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. You can listen to us on your smartphone using Stitcher or any of the modern podcast distribution apps, including Apple Podcasts, the mother of all distribution apps. I want to thank D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. D.R., it's really useful to us. We want to close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure, Ted.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.